I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Courtney White. He's co-founder of the Kivira Coalition. He is an author of several books. Jack Leffler is an oral historian, writer, radio producer, and environmental activist. And joining us by phone, Gary Snyder, author, essayist, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, author of 20 books, and backcountry grower of eggplants and okra. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Nice to be here.
We are talking today in honor of the Kivira Coalition, which is having its annual conference November 13th through 15th, Wednesday through Friday next month at the Embassy Suites Hotel in Albuquerque. And this year's theme is Inspiring Adaptation. Gary Snyder and Jack Leffler are the featured speakers. Now, are we talking about adapting to climate change, Courtney?
Well, we're adapting to change, climate being just one. And there's a number of things going on. I think folks understand we've got a number of issues, energy, water, as well as climate, and things just seem to be moving fast. And we thought, well, let's talk about what adaptation means in this context. And in the background, there's climate. We'll have a climate scientist lead off to talk about what the future looks like. But we're going to be talking about food. We're going to be talking about water, animals, livestock. We'll be talking about forests, all the kinds of things that we need to think about as we go forward. I mean, there's a lot of talk about what's different in the future from the past, a lot of sort of scientific talk about natural range of variabilities out there, ecosystems under change, and what does this all mean? It gets kind of bewildering, I think, for many, many people. So we thought we'd have a bunch of folks come in and kind of explain what they know and what they're thinking about.
For the last decade or so, when we talk specifically about climate change, we've been talking about mitigating climate change, radical reductions in carbon dioxide that's produced from burning fossil fuels. Have we given up? Have we surrendered to the fossil fuel industry?
No. It's important that we think about both. How do we continue to try to mitigate, bring down greenhouse gas emissions? At the same time, there's a certain amount of change that's built into the system. A scientist I know talks about being baked into the system. We're going to have a certain amount of heating, certain amount of dryness just coming down the road, kind of no matter what we do. And that's simply because CO2 builds up in the atmosphere and takes a long time to cycle through. And we put a lot of it up there, and they can do the calculations. They can say, well, here's how long it's going to be up there. We can maybe cycle it faster if we do mitigation strategies, but there's going to be some heating for a while. We are going to have to adapt to some new realities. So we need to do both. But it's very important, I want to make this point, that we're not trying to, by talking about adaptation, we're not trying to say that we need to stop thinking about greenhouse gas reduction. That's still the goal. That's still the eyes on the prize. Without it, at some point, then what are we adapting to? I mean, things just get warmer and warmer, probably beyond our lifetimes in that respect. But so it's both, and we had a conference on mitigation. We call it the Carbon Ranch, talk about how to sequester carbon in soils. That's the book I just finished writing on. But we at the same time have to think about, well, where's the water? Should we use it more efficiently? Should we think about, you know, rain and erosion and all that kind of stuff while we continue to work on the greenhouse gas side of things?
When we talk about adaptation, I mean, the Southwest and Gary Snyder, where you live, the Northwest, are filled with people who have been adapting to climate change, to environmental change for, what, millennia?
Right.
What are some of the adaptation strategies and ways of thinking that we can learn from indigenous people?
Wow. Okay. Well, one of the things that comes to mind here is hard times really inspire adaptation to happen. And that's something that the rural and indigenous people of ages past have really dealt with in beauty. A big thing that was dealt with 12,000 or so years ago was when we shifted out of the Pleistocene epoch into a much warmer habitat, which was actually human-friendly. But to get into something that I think is really important right now, I've been thinking about it as indigenous mind. That's a concept that doesn't preclude people other than Native Americans. I think that Native American people have a tie to indigenous mind, as do any rural peoples. who actually live out in it, as does my friend Gary Snyder, for example. But looking at the ranching people who have for generations now been ranching the arid Southwest, where the characteristic that sculpts culture here is aridity, and it will continue so and probably get even more arid as time goes on, the climate that is. People will have to adapt to that kind of thinking, and I think that the people who live in rural areas are probably more adept at adapting to these things than people who don't, because their ties to the flow of nature are considerably deeper as a result of having lived in these kinds of places for so long.
I'll just add to that as a little counter comment that the rural people of the West aren't very rural anymore. They are basically suburban, and they live with their cars and trucks, their electricity, their television, and their fast drives to the nearest mall. And we don't have nearly as many close to the land and thoughtful farmers or ranchers as we used to have.
What do you think that's about? What do you think is the draw of all of these things? I mean, just simply the comforts that are afforded by the mall and the electricity and all of that?
Well, that's normal American life, that's all.
I think that there's something that's alluring about modern life by virtue of supplying what is thought to be a more comfortable lifestyle. When I know that 50 years ago, when I lived in a hogan up at Navajo Mountain, Utah, I was one of two people up there who had a pickup truck. Everybody else either rode horseback, walked, or went in a horse-drawn team in a wagon. And what happened was a lot of people would come walking by my hogan asking me to take them into town. And you could see the handwriting on the wall. But it's true. Actually, in New Mexico, there are still a lot of rural people out there, a lot of ranchers that gotten to know over the last years who have been really looking in the other direction. And I'd like to refer to one guy in particular who has really inspired me enormously, and that's a rancher by the name of Sid Goodlow, who lives down near Caritzotzo, and who got what he would think of as his cow-burnt ranch back in 1956 and gradually restored it to a really beautiful natural habitat. But in part, he referred to a petroglyph on a cliff that exists on the ranch that showed both beaver and fish. And that inspired him to understand that at one time there had been a running stream right down through the middle of his ranch in what was currently a dry arroyo. And so he went to work on that, and by golly, now it is a running stream again. He doesn't have any fish or beaver yet, but taking a close look at a petroglyph on a wall, which was rendered by ancestral Puebloan people over 1,000 years ago, gave him the real clue that it was possible to restore this habitat to something that was much healthier.
We're talking to Jack Loeffler, Gary Snyder, and Courtney White about the Kivira Coalition's upcoming conference, and there's a wonderful issue of the Greenfire Times this month. It's devoted entirely to the conference. I urge everybody to read it. It's fantastic. Whether you go to the conference or not, you can pick this up free around town, Santa Fe, anywhere. You can also go to greenfiretimes.com. And in there, there's an article about Mimi and Tom Sidwell, who, I mean, maybe, Courtney, you can tell us a little bit about them. They take ranches that are just destroyed, overgrazed, down to bare earth, eroded, and they do restoration through very natural means.
They do, and they also produce grass-fed beef as a result. And kind of the point I wanted to make here is that when we talk about adaptation, folks who live in cities need to understand that this engages them too. Folks who live in cities are more buffered than folks who are in rural parts of the country. However, that they are dependent on rural people for food, for water, for those kinds of things.
Buffered until you have a superstorm in Manhattan.
Right. Buffered until the tap runs dry. Buffered until fill in the blank. And I think that part of the issue here is this kind of urban-rural divide that has grown over the last couple of decades. And I think as adaptations and mitigation issues start to rise, I think there's going to be more tension there if we're not more careful about trying to kind of maintain those bridges. The Sidwells are a good example. The Sidwells are ranchers out in eastern New Mexico. They practice a form of ranching that is regenerative, is healing. They bought the JX ranch. It was largely hard used, degraded. They, through their management practices, restored it. And there's this grass. There's a spring. It's got more water. Tom manages for drought, as he puts it, and is never disappointed. You know, drought always comes around. And by managing for it, he maintains a grass reserve. He manages his land very holistically, and as a result, he's doing well. And he produces they produce grass-fed food, which they sell to folks in cities. And so it's a nice link that way between their business, which is producing beef, and their management of the land, which takes care of the water cycle and even sequesters more carbon dioxide through the management activities. It's a nice link between that kind of urban and rural thing that we all need to be thinking about. And he'll be speaking at the conference.
One thing that I think is so cool about those kinds of land restoration that they do on ranches is that they actually use the cows to restore the earth.
They do. Aldo Leopold had a great quote years ago about wildlife. He said that the same tools that had destroyed wildlife can be used to restore it, meaning axe, fire, gun, plow, and cow. And I bet you that's part of Gary's experience with the chainsaw is doing exactly that. Our experience with ranchers is that if you manage the animal differently, you move it across the landscape differently, the grass comes back. And it's just a different, it's the same tool, different goal, really. What's your goal here?
But practiced with care, because it doesn't automatically work.
No, there's nothing automatic about any of this. And it requires constant vigilance and diligence and a caring heart and, you know, things that rural folks in general have and do. And sometimes we just kind of get ourselves in a jam with the need to get resources off these landscapes more quickly than we should, I think. Sometimes.
Yeah. I live in a place where I have dozens and dozens, literally, of neighbors who have no electricity. And I've lived myself without electricity since I built this house 45 years ago. A combination of solar panels and skillful use of occasional generators. And the adaptation that follows with that is considerable. Also, we don't have much water here, and there's no surface water because we're up in the mountains and the water's down in the canyons. So we are all on wells, and we all have learned how to do what little kitchen gardening work we do with the least possible amount of water. And the rest of the landscape at our elevation is very productive ponderosa pine and Douglas fir forest. But a few miles down the hill in a lower elevation, there are ranchers who are raising grass-fed beef. So we live right on the interface of both of those.
Courtney White, you talked a moment ago about the kind of urban-rural divide, and I think a lot of the time urban and rural people are pitted against each other culturally, and they seem to have different interests, and environmentalists and ranchers are pitted against each other and so on. What kind of common ground have you found? I mean, this is actually a question that applies to all three of you, because all of you are amazingly good at listening to and talking to and bringing together all different kinds of people.
Well, there are different kinds of common ground. I'll pick just one, and then Jack can jump in, because the quickest one is that we all live in a watershed. And I know that's kind of a cliche, but we do. I mean, you literally don't live in a watershed. Everybody lives in a watershed. And what happens in that watershed is critically important, especially under climate change, especially in an arid environment that's probably going to get more arid, and or longer droughts, that kind of stuff. So what we do in that watershed, how we treat each other, the management practices we put on the ground, whether it's forest thinning or ranching or grass-fed beef production, will affect water supply, it will affect water quality, it will affect everybody in that watershed, whether you live in Albuquerque or you live in Cundio. I mean, it's a we're in this boat together. we should try to row. And when you sort of talk to folks about where your water comes from, what kind of practices you want in that watershed, or what are you willing to support, those kinds of things. Well, I was in California last spring. It was interesting. I talked to a group of organic farmers, and they were trying to get folks in the San Francisco area to understand that adaptation was important to them, meaning the buyers of their food as well, that they had to help support those farmers who are in that Delta watershed, or if they went to China to get their food, then those farmers would be out of business, and then that watershed would start to have some problems because the stewards are no longer there. So just that simple kind of thinking about where you live. I mean, think about your home, and then think about what watershed you actually reside in, and what kind of activities you'd like to do there, especially under potentially drying conditions. And I'm sure Jack's got...
Well, I'd like to ask Gary to respond to that, because Gary is part of a watershed, and the people in your area, Gary, have really come up with a beautiful perspective. It's a collective perspective, and I wonder if you could talk about that.
Well, you know, we all know, and Courtney's written about it too, there are more and more watershed groups that have come into existence all over the country, but I'm particularly aware of, you know, my own territory, which is not just the Pacific Northwest, but it's the whole West Coast, that from southern Alaska all the way down to Baja, there are watershed groups popping up, and some of them have done remarkable work with things like salmon restoration in the Mattole River. Some are working on simply understanding and monitoring things that go on, and some, like around the San Francisco Bay Area, are dedicating themselves to daylighting urban streams and bringing them back out in the open again, and doing point monitoring of the water quality. This is not, however, something that everybody gets into. It is, like all of us, belong to relatively small populations of people who pay attention to these things. Then there's a vast number of people who pay no attention at all. And that's what we're up against.
There's a whole sense of attitude that has been evolving at least since the advent of the Industrial Revolution sometime in the mid-18th century that has resulted, you know, say seven generations past, if one's looking at it in that particular light. But we have grown ever more reliant on science and technology, sometimes well applied, sometimes misapplied. But the truth is that our system of attitudes is now more reliant on an economically dominated paradigm than an ecologically dominated paradigm. And I think that one of the things that's inherent in all of this right now is trying to find trails back into an ecologically dominated paradigm where we all perceive that we're products of the flow of nature ourselves. We are but an animal species. We may be alive, and we may be conscious, but we are an animal species that is alive and has somehow become conscious. And somehow we have to use that consciousness to start a new trend in a different direction than we've been going, say, over the last couple of hundred years.
You know, to jump in on that, where I find encouragement and hope as I travel around, and the book I just finished, largely with young people today. I think a lot of them get this. I think they understand the challenges. I think they understand they're growing up in a world very different than what Jack and Gary and I grew up in, with these kind of pressing questions that didn't exist 20 years ago. And I am very impressed by the toolbox, by the attitude, by the business savvy, by the educational deepness that the young folks today bring to these questions. And they're really standing on the shoulders of the folks on the radio right now who've come before them to talk about ecology, but also about practices, about good management, whether they're ranchers, loggers, water managers. If you go back 20, 25 years, that toolbox was largely undeveloped. And it's now you go forward just in time for these multiple kind of pressures bearing down on us, and you have folks eager to get back into food systems, for example, which is really encouraging. I mean, they're also daunted by kind of the challenges ahead of us, particularly how do you buy a farm, how do you buy a ranch, how do you produce food economically in a system that, at the same time, I have to say, where I get concerned is my children's friends don't go outside. You know, their kids, I mean, they're, you know, so you've got kind of a two-wave going here. You've got the young folks moving into food systems and thinking about organic and this and that. And then you've got a whole other generation that just doesn't go outside anymore. And yeah, that's really a challenge. And I don't know what the answer to that is, except to keep trying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so much of a role of the media in that, in just basically fear-mongering that if you do go outside, you'll be snatched away by evil kidnappers or whatever. But I mean, one of the most disturbing trends that I see is that people want their public outdoor spaces to be the equivalent of indoor spaces in terms of complete safety. And so they've gotten, and this breaks my heart to this day, I still have not gotten over it, they took away all the prairie dogs in the park across the street from my house. And the only explanation I could find for that is that they were afraid that some child walking along might get its foot stuck in the hole. So they spent all this money taking away the prairie dogs instead of teaching the children to watch where they were going.
This happens all the time, unfortunately. I jokingly call it Mothers Against Nature.
Right.
Let's say they can be talked into it.
That would be an acronym for MAN, M-A-N.
gotta be careful about that, right?
One of the things that I think about with regard to that is some of the practices that have begun to develop in rural areas. And this was a practice that was initiated in part by the Aldo Leopold family back in the 1930s and 40s, is the practice of restoration ecology. And it wasn't all that long ago, just about a year ago, another friend here, Bill DeBuise, and I were doing a project up in Moab, Utah, and he was talking about his book, A Great Aridness, talking about climate change, global warming, and consequences. And I was talking about restoration ecology. And some wonderful woman in the audience, her name is Jane Belknap, who is a soil scientist, said, the only thing is, at this particular moment in time, we don't know which ecosystem to which to try to restore, which I thought was a very interesting point. And I think that that brings up something. We, as conscious beings, we have the opportunity to try to extrapolate. For example, here in New Mexico, one of the things that one of our senators, Tom Udall, brought up is that we can anticipate the Chihuahuan Desert working its way northward into our pinon juniper grassland.
Right.
But one of the things that I think is important about that is to at least try to create a situation where it can assume that in some sort of Chihuahuan Desert health. And by so doing, perhaps we begin to restore our own consciousness of how to look at the ecosystem, the bioregion, and these things. One of the things that Gary has written eloquently about, and this is one of my favorite essays in the world, Gary, is your essay entitled Understanding the Commons. And that's something I think is worth talking about if you're up for it.
Well, what I was going to say was restoring an ecosystem is not difficult if you're willing to allow time. And this is a line of thought that I developed a lot in my book, The Practice of the Wild. Wild is a process. It's orderly. It's self-disciplined. It's self-managing. And human beings make adaptations. The wild proceeds to make things adapt. And any piece of land left to itself will be what it can be and what it will become ultimately in its own time and in its own way, so that we do not look at the deserts of the Great Basin, for example, as being unhealthy land. There's nothing we need to do for them, and there's nothing we can do for them. They are what they are, and that is part of how we have to understand the world.
We're talking to Gary Snyder, Jack Loeffler, and Courtney White, talking about the West adaptation environment, economics, ecology. And I think one of the things that the Kivira Coalition's work has really taught me is the lesson, which is going to have to be learned on a much larger scale than it's being practiced right now, namely that in order to have economic prosperity in the long run, you're going to have a healthy environment. If you just use it as a resource and use it up and throw it out, thinking that there's a greener pasture kind of just over the next hill, that's not going to work anymore.
It hasn't worked, and we've again buffered ourselves against the consequences of some of this unecological behavior. This is why climate becomes such an important issue, is that sort of the granddaddy of all consequences, and one that we can't simply push away. It affects all levels and all people indiscriminately. It's, if you have a national park, if you have a forest, a ranch, if you live in a city, you eat food, drink water, all of this is going to bear down on you and your interests at some point. I think it's important to understand that in this context that the West has always been adapting. I mean, people who've lived here have always dealt with aridity and droughts and fires and things like that. And this, we're not suggesting that there's any kind of static thing, static environment. It's always required us to think creatively, collaboratively, regeneratively. All of that's going to go up a big notch in the coming decades, I think. So then the question becomes, how do we, if we want to stay here, if we want to stay in New Mexico, how do we begin to manage these landscapes, live in these landscapes for a, what I call an unprecedented future, for a future that in some ways doesn't have a analog with the past if it gets, or at least within our lifetimes, which have been, in a fairly wet environment the last 20, 30 years, if they extend into long droughts, that sort of stuff. Then how do we stay here? How do we behave? Yeah. How do we manage? We've got restoration to do. We've got watersheds to work in. We've got food that we want to eat. And it's going to require kind of everybody kind of pitching in here and behaving in ways that are more regenerative than consumptive, I guess. And it's a tall order. I mean, as I said, it's sort of unprecedented challenges. And we need not to despair. I mean, we need to, and that's where the indigenous mind comes in. That's where we look to folks who are doing things already that fit ecological models as we go forward.
Well, like the Sidwell Ranch that we were talking about,
right,
where by doing ecologically sustainable cattle ranching, they actually make more money than the old way that it was done at the same place. That's a beautiful
right.
example. But then there's real issues, like we have all kinds of flood irrigation practiced in New Mexico that is a use of water that does not seem to really have long-term potential, and to actually get rid of that kind of agriculture and replace it with something else, that's a tall order, because then you're getting into people's land rights and land use decisions.
Right. Yes. Yeah. What Mark Twain say, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting, and I wonder about the drinking and the fighting as we begin to stretch our water resources. So I think, we begin to ask ourselves some questions about water use. Where should our priorities be? There's a lot of water use in agriculture.
Most of the water use
most
is
of
in
the
agriculture.
Water use.
And 80, over 80%.
Right. And is it used efficiently? Is it used to produce local food? Is it used for this or that? And the political power and the money resides in the cities, and so I worry about the tensions there as things start to kind of, well, we need the water, you have the water, those kinds of questions. Political leadership would be wonderful. There's some good political leadership. There's some not so great political leadership in this.
He's looking around the cafe.
Are they here? Anybody?
Where are they?
Jack! And so we have to work on kind of all these different levels. And it's not like when I was 20 or when Jack was 20 or Gary was 20. The world really does feel like it has changed quite a bit. And I come back to young people who are growing up thinking about all these issues. And I get, that's where the hope for me is, because it's not something that they have to shift away from. We have to do some shifting ourselves. Young folks understand a lot of these challenges. And if we can keep their spirits up, I think that's the main job, is to keep the spirits up. The toolbox is there. You know, the models are there. The ideas are there. The science is there. There's some good stuff. It's just how do you keep those spirits up so we can actually go forth and tackle these challenges.
The thing is, there's the alternative science that's there, the alternative solutions that are there that are not ecological or even necessarily sustainable, but would work for a century or two. You know, you might ask, well, what's going to happen to the Southwest when it runs out of water? Well, one answer to that goes back to the 1930s, and that is, well, run a pipeline from the Columbia River down into the Southwest, and they'll have all the water they need for a really long time. This will come up. This will be part of the discussion again, and then we'll be in the same position as we are, say, with nuclear-generated energy, having to decide whether or not we want to make that bargain.
Well, that goes back to your point. We have water in New Mexico. Agriculture uses a lot of it. So is the decision, if things get tight, to punt agriculture in New Mexico so that urban just doesn't, you know, then we buy our food. I mean, these are the kind of decisions that we should be talking about. And the answer, of course, for me is no, absolutely not. We need our agriculture. We need as much local food as possible.
Yeah.
But without that political discussion at some point, then if urban and rural just kind of go at it, then I'm fearful.
Well, I am too. But one of the things that I think is that, for example, Albuquerque, New Mexico, is by far the largest city in New Mexico and has in its surrounding area about half the population of New Mexico. And one of the neat things about Albuquerque is that no place that you stand in that city can you not see the rural New Mexico that surrounds it. And so it's not as far from the consciousness of the people in Albuquerque as it would be in, say, other cities like the canyons of Manhattan. That's a totally different scenario. But getting back to this, one of the things that I think could be developed here and is on the verge of being developed here is more of a level of reciprocity between the urban and the rural. And I think that people do see that in the times to come, the fact of becoming more regional, more local in the way we grow our food, the way we comport ourselves, the way we perceive ourselves relative to everybody else on the planet, is going to have to revolve around that sense of mutual reciprocity. One of the things that has inspired me over the years is that wonderful map rendered by John Wesley Powell back in 1888-90, yeah, running through there, that shows west of the 100th meridian in the United States. It shows about 150 different watersheds in the American West. And, of course, Powell was hoping to see governance occur from within the watersheds, whereas we created these other geopolitical boundaries. We were lobbied against, or he was lobbied against, by entrepreneurs who were more interested in turning the habitat into money. But the upshot here is that if you can look at that map, which I hope to have a bunch of to pass out at this conference in November, you can see modules of countryside that are interconnected simply by their common boundaries. And that is a way of looking at the land itself in a way that I think is probably going to lead us more into a sense of understanding that we are neighborly rather than separated by geopolitical or corporate beliefs. To me, one of the big things that comes to mind here, I've taken to heart a lot of the things that I've heard and read about the commons, the notion of the commons and common pool resources. One of the things that we've been adept at over the last couple of centuries is privatizing common pool resources, which to me is dead wrong. We can't look at it like that anymore. But what that brought up for me was beginning to understand that human consciousness itself is a sort of commons, and we have to be really careful about what we put into that commons and what we take out of that commons. And subsequently, we're on the edge now of having to understand that by putting some good components into that commons, which may have sort of disappeared over the last couple of centuries, that we could maybe restore our sense of consciousness of our place in nature as part of the flow of nature rather than as separate from it.
There's a really amazing paragraph in Gary Snyder's book, The Practice of the Wild, in which I think he's speaking to the common goals that so many of us have that you're referring to, Jack. And he writes, "Our conservationist environmentalist moral outrage is often, in its frustration, aimed at the logger or the rancher, when the real power lies in the hands of people who make unimaginably larger sums of money, people impeccably groomed, excellently educated at the best universities, male and female alike, eating fine foods and reading classy literature while orchestrating the investment and legislation that ruin the world." And that pretty much sums it up. And I wonder, how do you get to these folks?
Which folks?
Those people who are orchestrating the investment and legislation that's ruining the world.
Why don't we ask Gary to address that?
You'll get to them. You get to their children, if anything. And that's why we have all of these expensive global eco travel tours with young people whose parents can't afford it, is to get them out there so that they can actually see what the world looks like.
Well, this is a good question. It's a hard one to answer. I know a lot of folks in the environmental community ask themselves this question, in the sense that, do you work with corporations to make them greener? Do you kind of work within the system, or do you kind of step outside the system and fight tooth and nail? Fracking is a good example. I mean, you know, the answer to that question isn't clear. I mean, you possibly need to do both. We had Wendell Berry at our conference one year, and someone asked him this question, do you work within the system to change it, or do you work outside the system? And Wendell was very emphatic about, no, you can't, the same people that caused the problem can't cure the problem. You can't ask them to, you've got to step outside that system. However, having said that, that's hard to do.
Well, one of the things that I think is really important to consider here is that if indeed you start involving the corporate mind in the environmental mind, it's not unlikely that the environmental mind could get subsumed by the corporate mind as we quest for money to run our environmental organizations. And I think that's one of the big things that's we have to consider.
Well, you know, David Foreman wrote a really interesting and I think basically correct piece attacking the present manifestation of the Nature Conservancy as having been taken over by big corporations. Our national magazines, incidentally, as you may have noticed, are awash in greenwash. That is to say, big corporations taking out ads telling us how environmentally sensitive they are.
This is a discussion that you and I have had, Gary, and one of the things that I really rue is how much, so much of the scientific community itself is held within the corporate thrall. In other words, how much of the pursuit of science and the adaptation to different kinds of technology is being funded by the corporate system for its own sake rather than for the sake of habitat. To me, the big problem here is to really understand whether we can get the corporate people to understand this, who are managing the Nature Conservancy these days, or not, is to really collectively come to understand that we are all part of habitat. We have sprung from habitat itself. We were born of habitat. We are living organisms. And therefore, we have to really be very careful about where we look for our funding to continue our environmental work.
Yeah, and that requires a very sophisticated method of analysis, because it isn't always obvious. You know, just to say a word about capitalism, though, there's many kinds of capitalism. And the global capitalism that has large corporations that are not, don't have roots down anywhere, but are internationally located variously, are the ones that have no obligation to anything except profit. There are smaller scale, more old-fashioned types of capitalism, Christian capitalists, whatever, Muslim capitalists, Japanese capitalists, who at least have roots in some nationalism or in some religious position and carry with them a certain sense of morality. And we have to be aware of that difference, too.
That's a big difference. And sometimes the morality reflects, and this is becoming a growing concern to me, sometimes the morality of days of distant yore, say 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, are reflected in sort of a conflict with the fact of growing human population, and that sense of morality may no longer quite apply as it was once thought to have applied.
I think one of the problems is that there are so many pieces of the system that is just destroying our world that we like. We like the individual rights part of individualism. We like not being punished for what our brother did, for example. We like being able to go, at least for my part, I like being able to go and get Advil because it takes away the pain. And there are so many things like that. We've gotten used to being warm when we sleep at night and get up in the morning and being a whole lot cleaner than our hunter-gatherer forefathers. And we like those things. And I think the question of kind of how to have it all is a very, very tricky one.
Hey, Mary Charlotte, have you ever had a sweat bath, sweat lodge bath?
Yeah, one time, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody used to take those all the time, and our hunter-gatherer ancestors were probably cleaner than we are.
Well, maybe.
Certainly in some parts of the world.
I have to admit that I like to fly in airplanes, you know. I like to go places. I like to go. I've taken my children, you know, my family go. We go look, do things. So it's, you know, we're used to that. Maybe that's a sin on my part. That would be difficult. So, yes, and that's part of the point here is that there are no easy answers. There's no switch that you flip and suddenly we're on, you know, biodiesel energy sources. But nevertheless, it's what's important, I think, is that that we can have sort of philosophical discussions. We can have, you know, a lot of this has been kind of talked about for a long time. But now we have things bearing down on us and that are tangible and are consequential. And that's why at the conference we're going to lead off with Jonathan Overpeck from University of Arizona. He's one of the leading climate scientists. And his assignment is just to answer the question, adapt to what? I mean, what's coming? What does he see? So you take it out of kind of the abstract of, who knows? Let's, you know, for the good of this or that, we need to change our behavior. No, here are some tangible, serious consequences with some fuzziness around the edges, meaning we don't quite know when or to what degree, but nevertheless, the trends are clear. Drier and warmer, for example. You know, when exactly it gets drier and warmer? Well,
now, since the beginning of the 1900s, the temperature here has risen about 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right, right.
And so that's a very real piece of information. One of the things that I appreciate about this conference, it will be the presence of Bill Zeedyke.
Right.
Who said to me one of the most profound things is basically very simple. No matter what you do, there will be consequences. And so if we have any kind of consciousness at all, we should be able to extrapolate some of these consequences.
And inaction has consequences, too. So we're trying to do in this event is sort of talk a little bit about what are those, what's sort of on the map, what's coming. And then every speaker after that is answering that question. What do we do? So we have farmers, we have ranchers. We have biologists coming to talk about species issues because I don't want to leave conservation behind. How do they adapt? Do certain animals have to be translocated? What do we do to help? Those kinds of questions as we all begin to think about, it's a certain amount of change built into the system despite whatever we do right now. Let's think about adjustments, changes, whether at this level or a lower level, that we have to think about pretty quickly.
First of all in this, too, is that we learn where we are and who we are and become acquainted with the map, the watersheds, the plant ecology divisions, the ecosystem divisions, and what is the local rainfall at each elevation. That basic bioregional information and understanding of where you are, what's going on where you are, where your water comes from, where does your garbage go, is, you know, really kindergarten for doing these things.
I wondered if you could also, Gary, and maybe Jack as well, speak to the role of the arts during times of crisis like the one we're in.
Well, I'd like to see the Forest Service change some of its requirements and say that the ranger for a wilderness area is not required to write a report, but one haiku a year. because there's really very little that the wilderness ranger needs to do except, you know, to justify its budget. I'll let Jack say something about the arts.
Well, one of the things that I've been very interested in for my entire life is music, wonderful music. And subsequently, I spent a lot of my life recording music and performing music. But then somewhere about 45 years ago, I sat outside with my recording equipment and started listening to the local habitats themselves, listening to the bird life, listening to the coyotes, listening to wolves. Actually, I was able to record wolves. And that is an art form that seems to be expressed by habitat itself. At least that's my interpretation of it. Maybe it's an artistic sensibility to interpret the sounds of nature as art for their own sake. But boy, that comes as close to anything I can think of in those levels. It is the out of doors is visually an inspiration, but if you stop and listen, that penetrates very deeply and inspires a lot of that artful cognition.
It's a good question. I think about it a lot, actually. What moves people? What gets them to change? You know, a lot of facts, dry facts, a lot of science kind of hitting folks over the head. Doesn't seem to do it, hasn't done a lot of it so far. How then you take what the scientists have figured out, the ecologists, and then transform it into something that moves people, that engages people. In my own situation, I'm spending a lot of time on writing, on telling stories, trying to take complex ideas, explain them in a way that folks can get excited about grass-fed food, for example. You know, and you put a person, the rancher's story, in front of somebody and explain kind of all the consequences to their behavior. But without that kind of storytelling, without music, without poetry, without a visual element to all of this, we're just kind of throwing a lot of numbers at people. And we live in an age where there are just too many numbers. I mean, it's just too many.
Well, one of the things that I think is we can hearken back to our Native American friends who really use art in absolutely every aspect of their traditional lives, especially within the context of music and dance. And when one looks at the petroglyphs and pictographs on canyon walls and sees reflections of art, some of which extend back thousands of years, that represents a position within the human psyche that we have allowed a lot of dissipation to. We really have to get back to that and listen to. As a matter of fact, it would be great at some point in the future of Kivira to bring together a bunch of Native Americans whose perspectives are really still in tune with the flow of nature.
Yeah. Well, it's just about time to go. We could be here all day, gentlemen. But the Kivira Coalition is coming up very soon. It is November 13th through 15th, Wednesday through Friday, at the Embassy Suites Hotel in Albuquerque. This year's theme is Inspiring Adaptation. And there's a special dinner on Wednesday night, the 13th of November, with Gary Snyder and Jack Loeffler.
Right. So if folks are interested, there are two events involving Jack and Gary. One's a public lecture that's open to the whole public for a small fee. And there's also a private dinner we're doing. It's a fundraiser for the Kivira Coalition. We're very honored to have Jack and Gary help us out. Limited to 25 people, so if anyone's listening and would like to join that dinner and have a seat at the table, you're absolutely welcome. Just go to our website, check it out, let us know.
I'll be there.
You'll be there. I'll be there.
The website is kiviracoalition.org, and Kivira is spelled Q-U-I-V-I-R-A, kiviracoalition.org. The telephone number is area code 505-820-2544. You can contact Catherine. Jack Loeffler, Gary Snyder, and Courtney White, I want to thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Mary Charlotte, for having us, having me on, having us on, giving us some time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate it too, Mary Charlotte.